White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
Good morning, boys and girls. This is Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here in North Central Indiana, and it is a November the 15th, Tears Day, all day long here in the bunker. Nice day today, lots of sun, no snow, no rain, that's good. I'm going to introduce you to some of that so-called right-wing racist bigot anti-Semite Donald Trump's inner circle. You want to know about his inner circle? Okay, here's his inner circle. The first one here is Jason Greenblatt. Greenblatt has worked as a real estate lawyer for Trump for 19 years. He is one of the two Jewish lawyers whom Trump has said he would appoint as his Israel advisors. An Orthodox Jew and Yeshiva University graduate, Greenblatt studied at the West Bank Yeshiva in the mid-1980s and even did armed guard duty there. The father of six from Teaneck, New Jersey, does not have any political experience. Greenblatt has said he speaks with people involved in the Israeli government but has not spoken to any Palestinians since his yeshiva studies. He has cited the American Israel Public Affairs Committee as one of his main sources for staying informed about the Jewish state and helped draft Trump's speech at the lobbying group's annual conference in March. I think that's where Trump said he wanted to make Israel great again. Greenblatt, who has said he supports the two-state solution, has implied that Trump will take a more laissez-faire approach to peace-building. Okay. Whoops. Hold it. Quote, he's not going to impose any solution on Israel, unquote. Greenblatt told Israel's Army Radio last week. He also said that Trump does not view Jewish settlements as an obstacle to peace. David Friedman, another close-in aide to Trump. Alongside Greenblatt, Trump named Friedman, 57, as an Israeli advisor. Fieldman, a bankruptcy expert and partner on the Kazowitz law firm in New York, is the president's elect's longtime attorney, the son of a conservative rabbi with a family history tie to Republican presidential candidates. His family hosted Ronald Reagan for a Shabbat lunch in 1984, the year he won re-election. Friedman lives in Woodmere, New York, and owns a house in Jerusalem's Tel Aviv neighborhood, according to Haaretz newspaper. Friedman has expressed doubt about the future of the two-state solution, traditionally a pillar of bipartisan U.S. policy in the region, prior to the Republican Party passing a platform that omitted references to the two-state solution. He said it might be time for the party to reject the concept. Quote, the two-state solution might be one answer, but I don't think it's the only answer anymore, he said in July, which essentially is saying, Israelis, do whatever you want. Friedman has also said that annexing the West Bank would not damage Israel's status as a Jewish state. Oh, boy. Hold it. Okay, next is Kushner, Jared Kushner, the 35-year-old scion of one of New York's most prominent real estate families, and since 2009, the husband of Trump's daughter, Ivanka, playing a crucial role in the president-elect's campaign, especially in regards to Israel. He worked on Trump's speech to AIPAC annual policy conference that earned Trump a standing ovation from the Jews, and helped plan a trip to Israel for his father-in-law last year. Trump canceled the trip after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu slammed his call to ban Muslim immigration to the United States. Trump appears to be smitten with Kushner, often referring to his fantastic son-in-law when boasting of his pro-Israel credentials. Kushner, an Orthodox Jew who lives with his wife and his three children in Upper East Side of Manhattan, may have become a household name during the campaign, but he's no stranger to the limelight. In 2006, at 25, he bought the Observer newspaper. 2 years later, he became CEO of his father's company, Kushner Properties. 4 years after his father was sent to jail for tax evasion, illegal campaign donations, and witness tampering, in 2015, Fortune named Kushner its 40 Under 40 list, its annual ranking of the most influential young people in business. Ivanka Trump, Trump's daughter, Ivanka, 35, who converted to Orthodox Judaism, has served as a polished, softer face of her father's campaign. A successful businesswoman, whose brand is centered around empowering working women, she stood by him when the recordings were released last that caught the president-elect bragging about sexually messing around with women's butts and maybe vaginas. Ivanka has reportedly tried, not always successful, to have her father tone down or walk back some of his most inflammatory remarks, including having called Mexican immigrants rapists, according to the New York Magazine. Well, he didn't call them rapists. He said, we got to stop the ones who are raping from coming in. She is the founder of the Ivanka Trump Collection, a fashion and lifestyle brand, and serves as an executive vice president of development and acquisitions for the Trump Organization. Her father's company, Ivanka, who gave birth to their third child in March, belongs to the Upper East Side Orthodox Synagogue, Keilat Jerusha, with Kushner, and has described her family as pretty observant. She made Fortune's 40 Under 40 list in 2014, a year before her husband did. Oh, when you're a Jew, the whole world's wonderful. Boris Epstein. Epstein, 34, is a Republican political strategist and staunch defender of Trump, who has appeared as the president's elect surrogate on major TV networks over 100 times, New York Times reports. A New York-based investment banker and finance attorney, Epstein worked as a communication aide for Senator John McCain's presidential campaign in 2008, focused his efforts on the Arizona senator's running mate, then Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, who Trump reportedly considered for an Interior Secretary, according to Politico. Epstein, a Moscow native, moved to the United States in 1993, and he's already at the top of the heap. A fluent Russian speaker who has moderated a panel encouraging investment in Moscow, he may serve as an asset for Trump's navigating relations with Russia. Trump has expressed his desire to improve ties with President Vladimir Putin. Then again, Epstein's temper may make him less of an asset to Trump. TV hosts describe him as very combative and abrasive, and in 2014, Epstein was charged with misdemeanor assault after he was involved in a bar tussle. The charge was dropped after Epstein agreed to undergo anger management training and perform community service. Stephen Miller, Miller 30, has played a crucial role in the Trump's campaign, helping to warm up crowds at rallies and drafting speeches, including the president-elect's acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention. Miller, who has described himself as a practicing Jew, joined the Trump campaign in January, quickly rising through the ranks to become one of the most important people in the campaign. As Trump's campaign manager told the Wall Street Journal previously, he worked for 7 years as an aide to Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican of Alabama, helping the lawmaker draft materials to kill a bipartisan Senate immigration reform bill. Some of Sessions' arguments contain similarities to Trump's harsh and often controversial statements on the issue, such as calling for building a wall on the Mexican border and banning Muslim immigration to the country. Though Miller grew up in a liberal Jewish home in Southern California, he was drawn to conservative causes early. As a high school student, he wrote a letter to the editor of the local paper in which he slammed his school for providing free condoms to students and for making announcements both in English and Spanish, among other things. Stephen Mnuchin, a former Goldman Sachs executive, worked as Trump's national finance chairman during the campaign with the aim of raising more than $1 billion for the candidate. Trump and Mnuchin have been friends for 15 years, and prior to being in charge of Trump's campaign finances, Mnuchin served as an advisor. Part of what the New York Times describes as one of Manhattan's elite, most influential families, Mnuchin and his father both got rich working at Goldman Sachs. The younger Mnuchin also co-founded the entertainment company Rat Pack Dune Entertainment, which has worked on such Hollywood hits as Avatar and Black Swan. Some saw Trump teaming up with Mnuchin as unusual, considering the real estate mogul had consistently bashed Goldman Sachs, but it didn't seem to get in the way of a good working relationship. Trump is now reportedly considering Mnuchin for position of Treasury Secretary, according to Politico. Give me that fifth of whiskey. I can't take it anymore. Louis Eisenberg. Now, these are the people all around Donald Trump, the man that David Duke, the arch anti-Jew, anti-Semite, loves. Louis Eisenberg. Eisenberg, the private equity chief for Granite Capital International Group, serves as finance chairman of the Republican National Committee. He was one of a small group of Republican Jewish coalition board members who did not flee from Trump's candidacy and was a major contributor to groups backing Trump's election. Only 9 of the 55 RJC board members gave to Trump. Alongside Mnuchin, he works to raise funds for the candidate. Eisenberg grew up in New Jersey, and the Forward reported that he has been floated as a possible pick for Commerce Secretary in the Trump administration. He was the chairman of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey at the time of the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center. Eisenberg told JTA that he was extremely enthusiastic about a Trump presidency, calling him a strong advocate for Israel, a strong advocate for justice and order. I think he means Jewish order. Next is Michael Glasner. Glasner was not new to the Republican presidential campaigns when Trump appointed him last year to serve as his national political director. He worked as director of vice presidential operations for McCain's 2008 campaign and ran George W. Bush's campaign in Iowa in 2000. He has also worked with Palin and Senator Bob Dole, a former presidential candidate. Like many of Trump's Jewish advisors, Glasner is outspoken in his support of Israel. Prior to joining the Trump campaign, he worked as the political director for APAC Southwest Regional. Glasner has praised the anti-establishment movement, and he told Jewish Insider that his experience with Palin and the fact that he lives in New Jersey, not Washington, D.C., made him a good fit for Trump's political outsider message. He also served as senior advisor to Eisenberg when he was the Port Authority chairman. Also somewhere in there is Argentine business partner Moises Yalati, a Jew from Argentina. Allegedly, however, this crew has opposed to Huma and the Blumenthals, and also opposed to George Soros, which is not all bad. As I've told you many times before, Jews will get on any side of the argument. It's not what the argument it is, they just want to control the argument. Right-wingers, and a lot of right-wingers, don't understand that. They think all the Jews are marching in lockstep, but they don't. They control all sides of the argument. That's what they want. That confuses a lot of right-wingers and a lot of people. See? Well, wait a minute, that guy's this and that Jew is that. They're fighting each other. No, they're not fighting each other. It's shadow boxing. Let's go into a little bit more of this Jew stuff involved in the Republicans. Those were the best of times, arguably, but these may be the worst of times. That's the way most American Jews must feel as they wake up with a massive hangover from the shock election results and the reality that Donald Trump will soon be president of the United States. Whatever differences American Jews may have had with Barack Obama over the Iran nuclear deal and Middle East peace, they've never had a president who was more in tune with their Jewish and liberal essence. Obama was the realization of the American Jewish vision of a multicultural society, a dream come true for a generation of civil rights activists. He promoted the embodiment of liberal ideas that American Jews are more attached to than any other religious group in America. But don't leave the rest of them off the hook either. And he was more knowledgeable about American Jewish culture and Yiddishkeit than any previous president, bar none. Even when they disagreed with him, most American Jews, with the exception of the vocal minority that hated his guts, viewed Obama as a buddy. It's no coincidence, it's probably no coincidence, that during his tenure, American Jews reached a pinnacle of social and cultural acceptance. Being American Jews was hip. It was cool. It was a thing to do. From Jon Stewart to Jerry Seinfeld, from Joe Lieberman to Bernie Sanders, Jews seemed to be more entrenched than ever before in the American mainstream. Pew Research polls repeatedly confirms that Jews were the most loved and the most admired religious group in all America. Mashish Zeit, old-timers would say, but with a note of caution, because if Jewish history teaches anything, it is that all things must pass. the election of Donald Trump has shattered the Jewish ideal all across the board, although one must give the resident-elect the benefit of the doubt that he is not an anti-Jew himself. He has frequently promoted disparaging Jewish stereotypes in his personal statements. I don't know how much more pro-Jew he could be. Give me a break. Sunday evening's appointment of a former Breitbart CEO, Steve Bannon, as chief strategist in the White House is bound to exacerbate Jewish tensions. Well, if you know the facts, it won't. He is considered the standard bearer of the racist, anti-immigrant, alt-right movement and has been accused of harboring anti-Semitic sentiments himself, which is all bullshit. And the Dukeites and people like that buy into that shit. If you listen to what they say on Breitbart and what the founder of Breitbart has said and what they continually say. In fact, I'm going to get a recording out here and play it for you. And you'll see how anti-Jew Breitbart right-wing radio is.
They can't prove anything they're saying because what they're saying is false. Breitbart is not a white nationalist site. Steve Bannon is not an anti-Semite. It's just the usual smears. And the left, of course, is still intent from mode after losing the election. The never-Trump right, what remains of it, is also intent from mode. And so they're just kind of trying to find a way to undo the election in their minds, at least, I guess. But it's failing. But unfortunately, there are people who will believe it. So they have to just keep, they have to keep plugging away. But I'm glad that we were able to undo that last night.
Yeah, the apples and pears thing just has me. I laughed at that one. The other one was he referred to the alt black, basically implying that Breitbart is some sort of a white site again. And you really got him on the ropes toward the end, and he really did say that he thinks Breitbart is a white nationalist site. And I broke this down at the top of the first hour. It's a great reason to listen to the show on demand. I broke down the quite obvious and stark difference between nationalism and white nationalism. One is race-based, one is colorblind. American nationalism is colorblind, of course, and that's what Breitbart is. And, Joel, this is how media myths get started. They can be very devastating for a brand. And you see that the objective here is not truth at CNN. The objective is to try to destroy Breitbart.
Right. You know, you reminded me of something else, another point he made. I told him Breitbart wasn't a white nationalist site, and then he said, well, I don't read Breitbart. So if you don't read Breitbart,
yes,
how can you make a claim that Breitbart's a white nationalist site? You know, he felt offended by Breitbart. I mean, it's...
Yeah, he literally said he was offended by Breitbart.
Yeah, but he didn't read it, so...
Yes, right, which is both. He read it just enough to be... Just the second he got offended, and then he moved on. What do you make of the obsessive coverage at the Clinton News Network lately?
They're, again, trying to undo the results of the election by going through... I mean, the faces on election night at CNN were pretty low. They basically could not believe what they were watching. And I think they're trying to lash out and show that the election really should have happened the way they believed it ought to have done. And, you know, this is just more of a tantrum. And the riots are going on in the street. We're not hearing about that on CNN too much. Not hearing about the craziness of the protest.
No, we don't have time. And it's funny you say that, Joel, because I almost it was practically an apology what I said to the listeners at the start of the show. Which is that we have to waste another day on non-issues. Luckily, we got to a lot of headlines in the second hour. We've had some great interviews today. As a Jewish daughter, that his all three of his kids married Jews, that he has Jewish grandchildren, is somehow has appointed an anti-Semite as his top advisor. And it's the sort of thing that you would be alarmed, Joel, except for this is exactly what we have to do every election.
Yeah, every election and every time conservatives secede. I mean, the Tea Party was racist. Now Donald Trump is an anti-Semite, you know, and on and on. My favorite headline from Breitbart yesterday was the one about the Portland protesters who were arrested and half of them didn't vote. So,
yes,
you know,
I love that story.
That's typical. You know, most of them are about Breitbart's growth and success, social media and so forth. So what's really shocking to them is that we're effective. And that's what they're worried about.
Yeah, of course it is. That's the exact word. It's about being effective. And I just wish someone on the left would fess up to it. But no one will, and this is why they're very good, in my opinion, is because they understand that if they admit to their tactic, it's going to compromise them, because we have good internal memory now, largely thanks to Breitbart. Joel, break down some of the, just for, I hate to make you do this, but I do want you to speak, because I want you to speak personally as one of the veterans of Breitbart world, what it is like to work in this company.
Well, Breitbart is a fast-paced company where everybody works hard, where you know that every story you do contributes to the overall welfare of the website. It's not like the legacy media where they have this institution, big buildings, you know, hefty career salaries, all kinds of things like that. You know, we are a scrappy website.
I think it's a disservice to the American dialogue and to the American public, but luckily, I feel like more people are wisening up to this. So what are you looking for at the start of the Donald Trump administration?
And you know, as an employee at Breitbart, that what you could do, what you do at Breitbart could change narratives, could change history, really. But that every little bit counts. You have to be careful. You have to be driven. And one of the things you learn in media, and it is not unique to Breitbart or anywhere else, is that journalists are sometimes difficult to manage, very creative people. And people want to write and do all sorts of things. And, you know, what I think Steve brought to Breitbart is a focus. And that's one of the reasons for our success, is that he was able to tell this group of dynamic, creative people that, look, we have a job to do, and we can do all the stuff we want to do. We can do all the fun stuff, but we also need to focus. We need to get the news out. We need to break news. And that's an emphasis and a focus that I think Breitbart takes more seriously than a lot of other websites. And I think that that's the reason that we've seen our traffic go up. You know, when in doubt, the rule of Breitbart is always resolve doubt in favor of news. If the doubt is what the story is, go with the news. Don't go with opinion. Don't go with speculation, stick to news. And I think that's one of the reasons our readers come back, because we're providing news, we're providing information, and yes, that's really the premium in the news market. But in the legacy media, where they feel like they can fail and still survive, you're seeing a lot of opinion take the place of news. That's one of the reasons that they're losing readership and that they don't know how to find it again.
Yeah, and what's funny about it is that you even see people like Dan Rather, a discredited journalist who has lied to his audience repeatedly. He's going after us now, and it's funny because I actually have, you know, my own Facebook friends, people who like me enough to be Facebook friends with me, think I would work for some sort of an anti-Semite racist. It doesn't add up, Joel. None of it adds up. It's all media spin. Now speak to Madeline in Florida. Is it Madeline or Madeline?
It's Madeline. Hi, Alex. I'm a Hispanic attorney here in Miami, and I was the national co-chair of Latinos with Trump, which was
Wonderful. The
most prominent organization supporting Donald Trump in his campaign. And I consider myself a member of the alt-right, so I was confused by the panel last night, and nobody really cleared up what is the alt-right, because they seem to be, is racist, Breitbart is alt-right.
Yes.
Ergo, Breitbart is racist. But my understanding of it was it's simply an alternative to the mainstream right. Anyone on the right who isn't a pro-amnesty open border rhino. And I didn't really hear that come out last night. So what is the alt-right? And is it necessarily KKK fringe people?
Yeah, this is a great question, Madeline, and this is, I direct you guys to an article which has been the most substantial piece of journalism on the alt-right, which is called An Establishment Conservative Guide to the Alt-Right. An Establishment Conservative's Guide to the Alt-Right. It was written by Alan Bakari and Milo, they wrote it in March of this year, and it caused a big stir. And this is really the fairest hearing on the alt-right that's out there, and it describes all of its various forms. The problem is that the alt-right does have an element of people who, at a minimum, make racist jokes in it. And I don't think the American dialogue is comfortable with racist jokes at the moment in a lot of ways.
No, and I'm certainly not either, but it's compartmentalized. Like, even that quote that Don Lemon pulled out, I think it was clear that he was distinguishing the quote-unquote meme brigade, you know, sentence.
Right.
And And this is part of the fun part.
I'm glad you brought that up, because those of you who watch closely in the Don Lemon clip that I've been referencing, he's reading from the article, and the article is actually critical of elements of the alt-right, and Don Lemon doesn't even realize he's reading criticism. So the article, it shows that there's a lot of the alt-right that is really benign, if not even productive, which is these kind of younger, energetic conservatives who hate political correctness and want to stand up against it. And that is wonderful. But there's also an element of it that is a racist element of it. And I don't want to mess around with that personally, which is why Breitbart, I don't really consider us alt-right. I don't consider myself alt-right. I don't look to the alt-right when I'm making editorial decisions, as I told the Associated Press in the piece you can find on the Breitbart.com front page. But there's a struggle to define the word, and the left has gotten the upper hand, because if I was the boss, Madeline, what I would do is I would say the alt-right is just the part that I like about it, and the racist parts, we throw it out and we'll call it something else.
And that's how I feel about it. So why are we allowing them to put us all together with these, frankly, you know, disgusting people that maybe we've even hijacked the label a bit. I might say that's what's happened, but we on them. So how do we separate ourselves from them? They keep trying to push us together with them, and it's not fair.
Yeah, and it isn't fair. And this is the other thing. This is to me, and this is what Joel Pollack brought up. This is to me like associating CNN with the Black Panthers, because they clearly want the same agenda, which is a Hillary Clinton presidency. You know, they would all want that to be the case. So does that mean you take the most fringe element of the left and
people who say Black Lives Matter yet aren't, you know, people who are the most violent? Why does everyone who wants to adopt that phrase have to be lumped in with the more violent elements? And they go both ways.
It's a great point, and you absolutely do not have to be lumped in with them. And this is why you guys have to fight for yourselves and your personal lives and on social media, etc. But it's very the word has been tainted. I mean, the categorization of alt-right has been tainted, and part of this is because I do think what the left does is they try to come up with labels to neatly organize people, and they always do it to their own personal advantage. See, I don't think in labels. I'm not thinking of, am I alt-right, am I not? Breitbart News Daily. And it's just the sort of thing where it's a shame that the left is trying to do this, because much of this movement of young conservatives, many of them Trump supporters, who are trying to speak truth to power, for them to all get labeled in a way that makes them racist or associated with racist is just simply not fair. It's simply not the truth. But we have to deal with reality on reality's terms, as the saying goes. 866-90.
So there you go. The struggle, this phony, fabricated struggle between the left, the Jew left, and the alleged right-wing racist, who are not racist in any category that I would agree with. They're not racial separatists. They're not white separatists. They go around calling themselves white nationalists. I don't like that term, because we're working for white people worldwide. These guys want to go around white nationalists or my European heritage. Stuff like that. Instead of coming right out in the open and saying I'm a white racial separatist, and I agree with Tom Metzger and people like him. But most of the so-called racists involved in so-called white racial work are not truly racial separatists at all. They just play around with the term and then deny it when somebody, you know, like when TV reporter puts his mic up to a KKK leader, says, "Are you racist?" "No, I'm not racist." A lot of what the left say about the right is true, and a lot of what the right say about the left is true. But most are hypocrites. That's our national sport. But there are very few of us around. I have to admit that. I'd like to say there's thousands and thousands of us, but they're not. People who will declare their position as being white racial separatists, We are racial separatists, number one. Number one. These other people play around with it, but they'll try to use it to gain ground and make money, but they're not one of us. The only way we're going to find out whether they'll ever change is if a shooting war starts. And then you're in the same foxhole as the other guy. I mean, if I'm a right-wing, if I'm a racial separatist in a foxhole with a right-wing so-called racist, and the black legions and the Jews and everybody else are, and white sellouts are firing at us, I think they'll become hardcore race separatists very quickly. But until that kind of activity starts, to where you have to choose life or death, it's not going to change. But what really chaps my ass is all these people that are following these phony right-wing racists, so-called racists. They change their tune all the time. They're double-talking hypocrites. I mean, you know, for a guy like, I hate to even bring up Duke because I get sick of talking about him. But he is one of these guys that's following along the crowd, wants to use the crowd to build his name and build his mailing list while he's working for people that are infiltrated with Jews and everything else. This is not even to consider all the crimes he's committed against the race in the past that are identified legitimate charges, including going to prison for hijacking a lot of the money from the Klan and how he tried to sell the Klan mailing list back in the 70s. And I could go on and on and on. Joe Tomasi was a pure, unadulterated racist. And we've had a lot of those kind of guys. And Rockwell. You knew right where Rockwell stood. Wasn't any doubt about Rockwell. And that's what got him in trouble with his old right wing. We have all those recorded messages, recorded at meetings where they were conspiring all the time, the right wing, to destroy George Lincoln Rockwell. I'll tell you. Anyhow, let's go back to what's going on here with Trump and the Jews. Trump has repeatedly and unapologetically disseminated white supremacist tweets. Well, the left consider almost anything white supremacist. I mean, you can't even say, I think white is pretty nice. It's always white supremacist. That's a media term. We don't choose that term. Even the right wing, I don't hear them choosing that term. His campaign has used anti-Jew symbols that Trump has failed to disown even when advised of their offensive nature. You see, this they're trying to paint Trump as something he's not. He has distanced himself from his neo-Nazi supporters only under duress. Duress, they try to embarrass him. And under his wings, America has seen an unprecedented outburst of blunt and naked hatred of Jews, which has only gotten worse since this election. Well, I think most of that's coming from the universities. Jew leftists trained these people. Now they're turning on them. And also the large amount of Islamic people now infesting the universities. That's where most of this overt so-called anti-Jewish activity is coming from. They don't want to talk about that. Well, you let them in here. You kikes let them in here. You push to let them in here because you want open borders so you can carry on your various plots and conspiracies. So you let all those, help put all these Islamics in here, and now they're turning on you. In recent months, most prominent Jewish journalists and other public critics of Trump have been harassed by anti-Jews on the social media. In other words, they criticize the Jews. You can't criticize the Jews without being called an anti-Semite in their mail at home and in some cases in close physical contact. Hey, Hebe, out of the way. Oh my God, it's a hate crime. Swastikas have been painted at schools. Oh my. Most of the cities are covered with paintings of all kinds of symbols. I mean, Jewish students have been threatened. Well, Aryan students have been threatened too. Taunted. Told that Adolf Hitler was right all along. Well, they're so pissed off at the Jews, they say things like that just to bug them, whether they believe it or not. Along with Muslims, Hispanics, mestizos, and African Negroes, they're being targeted as sworn enemies of America First. Well, if the truth be known, they probably are. Yeah. The shock many Jews are feeling now is partly of their making. In recent years, the American Jewish establishment has willingly enlisted in the Israeli government's effort to depict ever-widening circles of anti-Israel agitation on the left as anti-Jewism. Well, if the shoe fits, wear it. The fight against BDS and the efforts to portray it as hatred of Jews in another form has consumed the time and energy and resources of the American Jewish leadership, with the possible exception of the Anti-Defecation League. And of course, I've told you something that the right wing, most of the right wing, don't tell you, and that is the Anti-Defamation League is just an investigative arm of the B'nai B'rith International Masonic Organization. The superpower is the Anti-Defamation League. Not the Anti-Defamation League, but the B'nai B'rith. They have B'nai B'rith groups in every city in the United States operating behind the scenes, while the Anti-Defamation League gets all the publicity because they're always finding bad guys or people who criticize Jews. While the B'nai B'rith does the dirty work behind the scenes. Meanwhile, virulent and classic anti-Jewism lurking just under the radical right surface. You notice they don't talk too much. They're being forced to talk some about the radical Jewish left. Anyhow, the radical right surface was virtually ignored and concealed by the mainstream right wing's overwhelming support for Israel. Even mentioning it was considered to be anti-Israel provocation. Trump's triumph has unleashed and pent-up resentment against Jews. I don't see that much resentment against Jews. It's just any criticism of the Jews. The sky is falling. Well, anyhow, I'm going to close out on this article because it's too much absurdity. Anytime anybody says, I got a bad sandwich at that Jewish restaurant, you're an anti-Semite, white supremacist, Nazi. You know, ISIS is funny. They're calling for terrorist, so-called criminal activity at the New York Thanksgiving Day parade. An excellent target. Group calls on lone wolves to carry out vehicle ramming attacks, singles out Macy's Thanksgiving parade as a prime target. I think it's funny the way ISIS plays the American press like a fiddle. In fact, actually incorporates them. All they have to do is make some wild statement and everybody goes crazy. That's a lot of power. And whether you like it or not, that's the kind of power lone wolves have. Not that ISIS is lone wolf, but it's interesting. All they have to do is come out with some wild-ass statement like that, and everybody goes crazy. Of course, the military-industrial complex, the FBI, and Homeland Security like it because they make a fortune. Keeping the people scared. Keep the people scared. Keep them in fear. That's the way you control them. So Hillary Clinton came up with, what, $90 billion for Saudi Arabia in weapons so they could create ISIS, so ISIS could scare the shit out of Americans. What a wild-ass world we live in. Says here, the ISIS terrorist group has threatened an attack on the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in New York City. Put out by the New York Post, of course. That makes the newspaper a lot of money. The more wild the news, the more fearful the news, the more money they make. Everybody makes money off this stuff. In the latest edition of its new English language magazine, Ramaya, ISIS called on its supporters to engage in ramming attacks with vehicles such as cars and trucks. The magazine gives instructions on what kinds of vehicles would cause the highest numbers of casualties. A ramming attack in Nice, France left 86 people dead and 434 injured. Well, that was because of stupidity. That was a stupidity because the truck was sitting all by itself on the street for hours, and one guy just sitting in it. Now, not only would the cops by law get that truck off there because there's going to be a parade, but they pull that guy out of there and check him out, which they did none of this. Most of this success of their so-called terrorists are stupidity on the part of law enforcement, military, and so forth. If you stick your chin out there, don't expect not somebody to not punch you in the mouth or in the nose or in the back of the head. There's a TV series on I get a kick out of called Ray Donovan. It was first of all on, I forget the service, but on the internet you can download it now free. And he's a lone wolf. If you want to see a lone wolf, watch that Ray Donovan show. If there's a problem, somebody needs something done, he does it. He goes direct. He don't screw around. And almost all the time he does it primarily by himself. But he's brutal. If somebody gets in his way, he kills them. I think the ISIS have been training maybe with that Ray Donovan show. Anyhow, if you got stupid cops and stupid FBI, like they let these guys that brought down the trade centers do their job when there was adequate evidence that they were going to do the job, well, what do you think people are going to do? If they want to do harm and you're not in their way, they're going to do harm because of stupid law enforcement. This is what the Jewish newspaper Arutz Sheva, which is a big operation, say about Steve Bannon from Breitbart, now working with Trump. He worked with Trump all the way through the campaign. Quote, in fact, as the Zionist Organization of America noted today, there is extensive record of Mr. Bannon and Breitbart's friendship and fair-mindedness towards Israel and the Jewish people. To accuse Mr. Bannon and Breitbart of anti-Semitism is Orwellian. In fact, Breitbart bravely fights against anti-Judaism. Yeah. Well, here's a little note we received from one of our so-called followers. I don't like that. I want people marching beside me, not following. Having grown up with and around black people, and having had tolerant listening to their self-destructive for white people, but self-serving for black people, colorblind promotion, propaganda. I noticed that such destructive ideas were almost always justified and rationalized by lies, and that these lies were almost always efforts to try to divide and conquer white people from one another's general mutual protection and uplifting, unity, so that they, the blacks, would have more freedom to try to take whatever they had or were in life. This is a little disjointed here. I have met a significantly large number of white people who were used as pawns in the George Soros-funded Puisiwandi International. Obanga encouraged BLM domestic terrorist movement, and every single one of them, almost all without exception, suffered serious personal consequences as a result of their selflessly stupid advocacy for such malevolent anti-white anarchist organizations, only to find afterwards that none of their fellow black revolutionaries' friends had any desire to help them, but only, in the best of cases, to allow them to recuperate just enough so they, the marauding, lavacious, amoral, all-consuming black people, could consume even more from their unwitting white tools. That's the end of that. That guy says some good things, but they're a little disjointed.
Down on gun violence. Right now, Chicago and state police, along with federal agents, are targeting high crime areas in the city's south and west sides. NBC5's Usher Qureshi joins us live from police headquarters with more on this criminal task force venture. Usher.
Lauren, police have seized more than 7,000 illegal firearms this year, and there have been some 650 murders in the city to date. This weekend, in a targeted crackdown, CPD is trying to make a dent in the crime plaguing some of the city's hardest hit neighborhoods. Dozens of police officers, squad cars, and a mobile command unit. The staging ground for operations at a restaurant parking lot at Central and Madison tonight. Day two of the Chicago Police Department's targeted enforcement mission.
Our goal is to stabilize these areas, and we do that by conducting traffic enforcement, traffic stops.
CPD is teaming up with federal agencies, including the ATF, FBI, and DEA, as well as the Illinois State Police and the Cook County Sheriff's Department. Hundreds of law enforcement officers are spending the weekend cracking down on violence across the city.
We just simply won't tolerate the violence.
Last night, Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson aided in capturing three carjacking suspects that had stolen a Lexus sedan in Cicero, ending up at Quincy Street and Laramie Avenue. Police have already recovered illegal firearms and are combing through hot zones of crime on the south and west sides.
Our main focus is gangs and guns, but we also want to look at other areas. We're not just specifically targeting one thing. We're doing parole checks as well. We're serving warrants.
The anti-violence mission will continue through the weekend, police say, once the operation is completed. The number of arrests, gun seizures, and other law enforcement actions will determine just how successful this weekend's mission turns out to be. Live outside Chicago Police Headquarters, Usher Qureshi, NBC 5 News.
Usher, thank you.
Well, the black KKK is on the run, going wild up there. They got the city of Chicago on the ropes. Not only all the cops in Chicago out looking for them, they brought in the funky feds to help track down all these weapons. There's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of weapons in Chicago on the street. They're not going to get them. This is all political. It's a cool show. Cool show of force. But the black KKK is still riding high in Chicago. And I imagine they always will, because they say there's 100,000 gang members in Chicago. So that means there must be 100,000 black KKK guys, or close to it. Well, we'll keep an eye on this Chicago situation. Sooner or later, there's going to be a breakout, a major rioting. You'll see. It's coming. Tick, tick-tock, tick-tock. That's it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. In the meantime, get away from that old right wing, and you'll know it when you listen to them, because the most important things they need to be talking about, they don't talk about. 14.5. For instance, how many right-wing websites or radio shows do you hear them talking about being anti-war and cutting those military-industrial complex items in half and getting out of the Middle East? How much of that do you hear on the right wing? I don't hear any of it. Well, I'll dedicate this music going off the show here for today to the Chicago Black KKK. How about it?
Riding north on Interstate 75 with a nervous fading beauty sitting by his side and a pistol that he used to pave the way down the long black stretches of a dark highway. Ray bought his future with a pound of lead. Then he robbed a liquor store and left the clerk for dead. That kid should have put the money in a sack, but he didn't, and now there ain't no turning back. He's a desperate rider, he's a Jesse James. The best thing he can hope for is a household name. There ain't nobody that a man can trust when all his headlines read notorious. Struck with the lights off to avoid the roadblock. Ray killed the motor at the county line. Changed his Tennessee place to a lost tag sign. She had never asked what the boy had done, but she said she'd be his hostage if he needed one. Her mama raised her to be loyal and true, and she figured that's the least that she could do. She was lost and lonely on the midnight ride, reluctant Bonnie to a poor man's back. It ain't too easy when the man you love has got a reputation that's notorious.
No, Toria.
go, Black KKK.